Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my guest is Linda Carlton, and we're going to be talking about her new book, Elmina's Fire, and also be talking about her work with mandalas. Linda has spent a lifetime integrating her Christian faith with a love for the world's religious traditions. For 25 years, she has taught high school history and comparative religions in Connecticut. A wonderful spiritual teacher led her into the United Church of Christ, where she could openly wrestle with God. Linda came to feel more secure in her faith following her first mystical experience, which was during a traumatic emotional period. A few years ago, Linda joined an Episcopal church that feeds her mystical nature, observing that, once I accepted, I did not want to be in the role of an ordained minister, sliding into the Episcopal church was like slipping into a comfy glove. Linda and her husband Peter retired to Maine in 2008, where she begins each day writing morning pages and meditating. Linda paints, writes, and teaches English to refugees. She finds that working with mandalas draws her into her spiritual center. She began painting mandalas with a main theme and also creating custom mandalas for individuals and businesses. She teaches workshops and classes on mandala journaling as spiritual practice, which tap into the energy of each of the mandala and great round. Linda has just completed her first novel, Elmina's Fire, and also writes a bi-weekly blog reflecting on such topics as mandalas, her faith, and Peter's journey with cancer. You can find out more by visiting her website, which is www.lindacarlton.com, and I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Linda to the show. Good day, Linda.
Well, good day.
Thank you for having me. Now, am I pronouncing that right, Elmina, or is it Elmina?
It is Elmina.
Elmina, okay. I just wanted to make sure.
French word, Guillemina.
Okay. We're going to talk a little bit about how French played into it, so I should probably have kind of figured that out. But anyway, I'm glad I got that right. So, I'm really looking forward to talking about both Elmina's Fire and mandalas. I think that those, I'm fascinated with those two. So, first of all, let's start with what in your background do you feel makes you an expert or gives you the subject matter expertise for your message?
Oh, my goodness. First answer that comes to my mind is I don't exactly consider myself an expert in much of anything. But
okay.
I have a lot of experience with ideas in the spiritual realm and with mandala and art. So I started my journey teaching comparative religions at a public school in Connecticut. And that was really my first introduction to the world's religions. I came in one September, and the person who taught the course had left, and I was just told, you're teaching comparative religions. And so for the next 25 years, I did that, and in the process, took a lot of courses and gained a lot of knowledge and appreciation for the ways the world's religions approach the sacred. And so that was a bit of my background, the beginnings of my spiritual awareness.
Now, reading in your bio, it seemed like as a child, religion wasn't a major part of that environment, correct?
No, it was not. I grew up in a family that was hostile to religion, to all religions, but particularly to the Christian religion. And my father had fought in World War II and had absolutely no use for any sense of God or anything that smacked of being sentimental. And I even remember as a kid that on Sundays we'd go for Sunday drives, and he would go out of his way so he didn't have to drive by a church, because he claimed that people coming out of church were in La La Land and they wouldn't look both ways when they crossed the street and he'd have to run them over. I had no church. Well, that's not quite true. I had very little church experience. This was in Northern Virginia at a time where they still said the Lord's Prayer, the 23rd Psalm, and morning devotions in the public schools. It was a time when everyone in class was supposed to name their favorite hymn and name hymns, and
Linda, you were kind of going in and out there, and I
oh no,
I just wanted to make sure.
Is this
better? That's okay. That is better.
This ear?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
I will definitely stay away.
Okay, that's,
keep this phone over great. In that direction.
Okay,
so,
great. Yeah.
So this teacher, make a long story short, called my mother and complained that I knew nothing about religion. And shortly after that, a Bible story book appeared in our house, and we were dropped off at a Sunday school for about 3 months. And the one thing I remember learning was that Jesus was such a good little boy that he made his bed every single morning without his mother ever telling him to do it. So that didn't endear me to Jesus. And
really?
It was my only experience with religion as a child.
Wow.
So when I was told I was teaching comparative religions, I knew a bit about religion in American history from having majored in history and, learning some of the religious controversies and the impact of religion in American history. So I wasn't going at it completely blind, but I was learning right along with the kids.
Wow. Well, that's great. I mean, that's one of those things where so often our childhood gives us little clues. I mean, it's always in hindsight, of course, but I mean, gives us a little bit of clues maybe where our life is going to, some of the journey that our life is going to take, and some of the areas
mm-hmm.
that it's going to touch. Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
And
so,
Go ahead.
I was just going to go ahead, but I wanted to continue.
I had the interest because I would hide under the covers with a flashlight and read that Bible story book, kind of out of embarrassment that my father would discover me reading it. So I had an interest as a child.
Yeah. Well, if he went out of his way, to avoid that, and I think with every child, it's like, if he's going to avoid it, then I'm going to check it out and see what it is.
Right.
He really did a little bit of a rebellion sometimes with children and parents. But So what do you tell? First of all, I guess maybe we should talk a little bit about Elmina's Fires. What's the book about?
Oh, my goodness. The book is about a young medieval woman who grows up in the south of France, right on the edge of the Albigensian Crusade, which I really knew nothing about until I got into writing this book. But it turns out that this was a war fought by the Catholic Church against a group of Gnostic Christians called the Cathars, and started 1209 and went until around 1228, and then had skirmishes for another couple decades, and then gave rise to the forming of the Inquisition when the Cathars kept popping back again. And the book is about Elmina growing up in a family. Her
okay, I'm losing you again. Sorry.
Her father was a Catholic who would take her to the Catholic Church, and her mother was a Cathar who had were the church at all. And so even as a child, she was pulled between those two faiths. And then when she came of age, her parents didn't have money for a dowry. So they sent her sister and her to a Cathar school for girls, where she became immersed in the Cathar beliefs and drawn to the kindness and spirituality of the Cathars, but was very conflicted while her sister Amela loved the Cathar faith. And oh my. So let me answer your question quickly. What's the book about? The book is about Elmina's struggle with her faith, both at the Cathar school and then when she breaks from the Cathar school to follow this priest she's enamored of, to the first Dominican convent, and finds herself complicit in the really great evil of the Albigensian Crusade. So she's wrestling with her faith, and she's wrestling with her conscience.
Wow, wow, that's a lot of internal conflict for one to go through.
There's a lot of internal conflict for one period of history and one little girl, one young woman, between.
Yeah. So now, speaking of the Cathars, I'm going to be ignorant about it because I really don't know much about them. So what is it about the Cathars' beliefs and the religion, and what about it is relevant for in today's world?
Wow, what a good question. Okay, the Cathars were Gnostic Christians.
Okay.
And what that means, a number of things, but the ones that are most relevant are things that still split sort of New Age Christians and more traditional Christians today. And there seems to be no reconciliation among them. So one of the divisions they had was about the nature of where does evil come from. And to the Cathars, it was impossible that a good God would create a world of evil and suffering or allow such a thing to happen. And so they concluded that God did not create the world, that God was a holy spiritual presence, and that people are kind of entrapped on the physical plane. And their goal through living a perfect life is to free their souls from the material condition The Catholics believed that the reason for sin, a reason for suffering, is human sin, and the choice, which is symbolized in the choice of Adam and Eve to disobey God and to sort of start the wheels of disobedience from the good of God in motion. The Catholics had a more sacramental sense of the world, that the world reflects the glory of God and that it's human beings that have messed it up. So that's one difference. Another difference has to do with eternal life. The Cathars believed that the human soul strives for perfection. And if they don't reach it in one life, then they're reincarnated many times over, infinite times over, until they finally are able to become perfect. And the Cathars called their leaders the perfects. And, of course, the Catholic Church believed in an eternal damnation and salvation in heaven and hell that set the two at odds. And the Cathars believed that the Catholic Church was the incarnation of the devil on earth, and the Catholic Church believed the same thing about the Cathars. And so the whole question of the nature of life after death is something that is as relevant today as it was back then.
That too, and then the, you know, the idea of the origin of evil, you know, and
yeah.
I mean, I think that one too, you know, really plays into very much to today's, you know, questioning as well.
Yeah. Very much so, because it's not a question that any religion has been able to answer. That very first cause of how whatever is one and whole and perfect gives rise to multiplicity and change and ultimately evil. No one can answer that.
Very much. Now, you touched on one of, you know, the beliefs of the Cathars as being the, you know, the theme of reincarnation. And
yeah.
And you know, that does fit in certainly much more with kind of newer thought, you know, New Age versus traditional Christian teaching. With that, what was your belief in, or is, was and is your belief in the idea of reincarnation? And do you have any personal experience with that idea?
Well, yes. I have thoughts. I'm not big on beliefs because at heart, I don't know the answer to any of this. So I have experiences and so why don't I talk first about beliefs, thoughts about reincarnation.
Sure, please.
And experiences. No, I won't. I'm going to reverse that. I don't know how I'm going to do this. I'm just going to
talk to you. Sure. You're the guest. You can do whatever you want.
So, when I was teaching comparative religions, of course, I was very familiar with the idea of reincarnation. And I found it a far more appealing idea than any belief in heaven and hell as an eternal solution to. And so I've never been able to subscribe to a loving creator of the universe who would damn people to eternal hell for this thing or that thing or the other thing. That just has never sat with me as a belief I could hold on to. And it was one of the things that kept me out of the Christian church until I discovered there are many Christians that don't hold that belief. So I came into all of this not believing in reincarnation and having no experience with reincarnation, but seeing it as a solution to our life's journey than traditional Christian beliefs. But I was also by that point ordained in the United Church of Christ, which does not have any belief in reincarnation. Although if you go to Pew polls, more than 25% of American Christians today believe in reincarnation. So it's no longer really meaningful to say, well, Christians believe that and they don't believe this. But certainly the traditional tenets and of the faith don't allow for reincarnation. And I couldn't talk about reincarnation from the pulpit of a church, say. So with that as my background, I was having tea with a friend on an island off the coast of Maine. And I was talking about some of my conflicts, some of my restlessness with the church. And as I talked, she just sort of in the middle of what I was saying said, "You know what, Linda? You have a past life experience that is keeping you from making peace with the church."
But that left you speechless for a second.
I said, "What?" And she said, "Well, I know that may seem strange to you, but," and she went on to talk with me about a book that she had read that she said she'd be willing to loan me if I was interested. And it was a book by Roger Wolger called, oh my gosh, the name has just flown out of my head and it'll fly back in again. But for this very moment, I'm just going to say she told me about Roger Wolger's book. And I was curious enough to devour it and to discover that he was a Jungian analyst who had no experience with or belief in reincarnation when some of his clients began to have past life experiences under hypnosis. And he talked about three ways that you can understand the past life experience. One of those ways is to say that the past life experience is a psychological projection of some sort that we draw from our unconscious images and things we've heard and seen that particularly appeal to the needs of our psyche, and those things become conscious, very much as, say, a novelist writes about a character that is in some way a projection of her own self. So that's one possibility. Then he talked about the Jungian sense of it. And in Jungian psychology, there's this concept of the collective unconscious that really stipulates that we are connected to everything that has ever lived, every experience that's been experienced, that there is a plane on which everything is part of the great collective.
Right.
And that you can look at past life experiences as just bringing to consciousness one piece of the collective unconscious that your psyche needs at that moment. So your psychological processes will like open a portal and let that piece of the collective unconscious emerge. And then a third possibility that to explain past life experiences is reincarnation, that we actually have many lives, and that live within us, and that for one reason or another, some of them become conscious to us through dreams, through hypnosis, in different ways. And so I went back to this friend to talk with her about the book, and she said, well, if you're curious, I know someone who trained under Roger Wilger and who does past life regressions. And I was curious. And I knew that I had strong emotional issues relating to the church and to other things that I hadn't in any other means been able to resolve.
Mm-hmm.
And it helped me that she said that this therapist wouldn't do a past life regression unless she was convinced that it was something that would be helpful. She hadn't done one for my friend. And so I knew it wasn't someone just out to collect money by
right.
doing past life regressions. So I went to her and did a regression. And a life appeared to me that I took home and did mandala work with over the course of the next few months, and found a big piece of my angst resolved.
Hmm.
Ultimately, enough that we decided our work was over, and I would say goodbye to this therapist. And so we had a goodbye time, and kind of near the end of it, she is prone to intuitive hits.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you know, you might on your own want to do some work with a life you had among the Cathars where you betrayed someone you love. And that was the origin of Elmina's fire. At that time, I knew nothing about the Cathars, or nothing more than the sentence or two you learn in divinity school. And so I began to do reading and discovered that there were 9 young women who left a Cathar school to follow Saint Dominic into this mud hovel of a monastery right on the eve of the Albigensian Crusade. And it just resonated. I mean, it just went strong in my psyche that, oh, man, those are the lives that I'm interested in. Those are the lives that I'm connected to place. So I just started writing, and it poured out of me. The book is written in the first person as a prayer of Elmina talking to God at the end of her life. And it just flowed for about 30 or 40,000 words. And then it stopped. And it was getting too much in my head, and I was getting the sense I was trying to invent something, and I realized I needed to go to France, to the place where she had lived, and to get a more grounded experience mm-hmm. of whatever that life might have been. So when you ask, well, what do I believe about past lives? I believe that something in me is connected to this life of Elmina. And I don't have to know whether it's because of reincarnation or because of the great collective unconscious. I just have to trust that I was to get this, have this experience and write this book. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Wow. Well, a lot of it does. Yeah, a lot of it does, yeah. Very much so. And, you know, the one thing, you know, when you gave the three possible explanations for, you know, past lives, you know, those are three, you know, that I've heard before, and it seems that, and I was glad to hear you say it really doesn't matter in the essence that, you know, you connected to that energy, you connected to something that allowed you to have a 30,000 to 40,000 word flow, which is, I mean, for anyone who's written, no, that's a lot of flow to come out.
Well, and then when I went to France, I stayed. The monastery where she lived is no longer there, and all the stones were removed during the French Revolution. But another monastery was built on the same site at the end of the 19th century. And so I stayed there and sort of took a private writing retreat to finish the book there. And the flow just started again.
Wow. That's amazing. Well, we're about halfway through the show, Linda. I want to take just a quick break, and because I do invite listeners to call in if they have any questions, and if they
okay.
do, they can call in. They can call in at 619-789-4359, and for those listening live in the chat room, if there's any questions, they can type them in there. It's just a short, like 90-second break or so, and then when we come back. You know, I kind of would like to talk a little bit more about France, you know, and you
okay.
know, some of the things that, you know, maybe additional research that you did while you were there, and then
yeah.
continue on to talk more about that, and also talk about mandalas, too. So
okay.
everyone, stay tuned. Great. Everyone, stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link to the approximately 1,000 shows that we have had over the past 5 years. Our show is available as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. You can subscribe there, or even quicker, there is a link to our show on iTunes on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, etc., and we have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. And finally, also on the site is a link to the great products we provide: books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store with essential oils and personal and spa products. There is so much for you to explore and enjoy on our website, www.biteradio.me. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today my guest is Linda Carlton, and we're talking about her new book, Almina's Fire, and we're also going to be talking about her work with mandalas. So, again, you can find out more about Linda by visiting her website, which is www.lindacarlton.com. And, again, I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. Okay, so with that, we're back, Linda.
Okay.
Okay,
I'm
great.
Here.
So now the monastery in France was rebuilt on one. So, question: when you were there in France, did you have any kind of internal resonance with with the area, the people, anything like that? That maybe.
Oh my God! Yes.
Okay.
So I. Mm-hmm. When I flew into Toulouse and rented a car and sort of drove down through the Languedoc region. And when I came up over a hill and I saw the region flow over me, I started to cry.
Oh.
There was just something about those undulating fields and that felt so familiar. And not much that was there in the 13th century
mm-hmm.
is there now, but there was something about the shape of the land and that resonated a lot. And then it takes place. Almina grew up in a medieval test room, they call it. It's a walled-in town on a hill, and it burned in the 1300s in the 14th century. So there's, her house as she lived in it isn't there anymore, but the grid of roads remained, and I found myself just with a sort of gut sense walking around it. Well, this had to have happened here, and this had to have happened there. And the church up on the hill is not the same church she was in. But I had the sense, well, the church ended here, and this one's bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So, I just take all of that for what it's worth. There was a very strong sense of returning to a place I knew, and a very strong sense of doing reconciling work.
Mm.
That it, it's no secret in the book, because the book begins with Elmina's quandary as she is contemplating killing herself. And so by the end of the book, you know that's going to happen. And and I think I had been unable to face that piece of her story by writing at home. And when I was in France, that piece flowed out of me.
Mm.
In a very, very honest and emotional way.
Wow, that's a, first of all, whether or not you had that particular lifetime, past lifetime, or if you were just tapping into that, collective consciousness aspect of a time period or that kind of thing, to me it's, whenever we encounter anything in life that resonates at such soul level that brings tears to our eyes or gives us, chicken skin, as they say in Hawaii, or the goosebumps, those kinds of things, whenever there is something that I feel, whenever there is something that touches us so deeply that there is That is a that is something that was just like absolutely meant to be. I mean, it's something that it's one of those, I wouldn't say spiritual experiences, but I mean it's pretty close to that idea.
Yeah, but it is.
Of that, you know, and so you know, and I just found it interesting that you know the that Elmina's challenges or experiences with religion, you know, kind of mirrored in a way, in a sense, you know, the idea of your early childhood, you know, with your father's, you know, strong, you know, anti-religion, you know, kind of beliefs. So, I mean, it, to me, it was just interesting that it was like a perfect setup, in a way,
right.
for you to to experience.
Yeah, I feel that it did, and that there's so many places of the life that I've written about in Elmina that tap into my own experience during this lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you, well, first of all, you know, with Elmina, what would you say, who would she be like today? I mean, is there an archetype that you would use to describe who she is or was?
One hasn't just jumped to my head. She's a course part of the persecuting class. So in some ways, she's all of us, and all of us who in this world are complicit in just the enormous evil perpetrated by our system and society. And someone who is both complicit and trapped. Very few of us can opt out of the social system we've been born in. And if we choose to do that, then, you know, we are in the hands of the persecutors. So she is an archetype for all of us in the complicity we all have with the evils of our time. She is an archetype for those women living in cultures all around the world and some places in our own culture that give virtually no life choice to women.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that she made the choice to leave the Cathar school in the hope of following Dominic is a pretty extraordinary thing given the time she was in. But once she made that choice, there were no other choices left to her. And she wrestles and struggles with that one.
Well, she seems to epitomize a lot of the struggles with women have today. And I noticed, too, that you do work with refugees. So I would think that that would also be it would be a kind of a similar type of a persecution in a way that you're trying to help alleviate.
Well, and I've been drawn to working with refugees, and have been aware that there's an element of needing to atone for something in the ways I've chosen to do that. and this lifetime where she feels so personally responsible for what happens to her people and to her sister. I think by writing this book and experiencing her life, I've been set free from that sense of guilt that had driven the work I do during much of my earlier life.
Yeah.
And the neat thing about past life work is that it doesn't matter. I think you said that earlier. It doesn't matter what you believe about it for it to have incredibly liberating effects.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, to me, you know, I would kind of go along with Jung in a way that, you know, that our psyche really seeks out the help that it needs, so to speak, you know,
from
be it conscious or subconscious or superconscious kinds of areas, you know, wherever, you know, whatever can help us, you know, the psyche kind of goes out and let me go out searching and find kind of thing. Exactly. So now, you know, when you talked about the liberating effect, you know, for you that I had with writing Almina's Fire, is that one of the things that you hope the readers will also experience, is that liberation?
I hope the readers, I don't think you can experience that kind of liberation from reading someone else's story. I hope they will experience compassion for themselves and for those that that they may have judged under other circumstances, that for none of us, life is as simple as black and white. And so people who have read it find themselves feeling a great deal of compassion for Almina, despite the fact that she was on the, I would say, wrong side of a very horrendous event in world history.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, so, we're getting already down and talked to the last 15 minutes here or so. So everybody should go ahead and read Almina's Fire. But I want to talk now spend a little bit of time about talking about mandalas. I find them fascinating. So would you mind kind of sharing with the listeners, it's just a little shift here in focus,
okay.
You know, what was your, how did you get interested in them? And tell us about your history with mandalas.
Okay. So first of all, it's not that great a shift because there's some evidence that the Cathars were aware of and worked with spirit drawings in a sacred circle, which happens in the book. And I got aware of them through my church in Connecticut, and there was a director of spirituality there who did mandala work. And so I was part of the mandala growth group for maybe 5 years and then became trained in something called MARI, which is the Mandala Assessment Research Instrument, but it's a way of exploring your psyche through the use of color in mandala. And at that point, then I retired and moved to Maine, and at that point I was a landscape watercolor painter and painting island scenes and finding myself getting tired of it and also painting to a tourist market. And and I walked by someone's lobster shed that had this big red door and just nifty stuff hanging all around it. And I saw it as a circle. I saw a a mandala created around it and by it with all the elements of it. I went home and just started turning the elements of this lobster shed into a main mandala. And that was really fun. And so then I started doing that with other scenes and other places and for people who wanted to turn their own life and experience into mandalas. I would interview them and do custom mandalas. And I became increasingly fascinated by the flower of life, which, if there's people who don't know what that is, it's something you learn when you're a little kid. You take a compass and draw a circle, and then put point of the compass on the edge of the circle and draw another one and draw a circle at the intersection until you've gone around and drawn six more circles, and it makes a flower. And then if you just keep doing that, working out that out, you can do it for infinity. And Plato discovered that every shape, all of the Platonic solids, can be formed by connecting points on the flower of life. It's like a universal grid. And there is something energetically just incredibly healing about working with the flower of life. Drawing it, coloring it, meditating with it. It has an energy of its own that just is, I don't know how to describe it, because you can't describe mystical stuff really. So I have done a lot of mandalas based on the flower of life. And right now, I don't know, can I say anything about political stuff?
You sure can. Sure, go ahead.
On the air?
Sure,
so
yes.
I've been very troubled by the political life in the United States and was active in protesting and then became really lethargic and despondent and was meditating with the flower of life. And I had this image of an art series called Transforming Trump. And now and for the next 6 months, I take the news headlines and make a collage of them and then paint a flower of life mandala over them. And in the process of collecting the headlines, I get in touch with my feelings and thoughts about these headlines. So it cuts through my lethargy. And then in painting first a veil of white so you see the headlines through the white, but as if through a veil, and then painting the flower of life over them, then peace, more at peace with what's going on, more in touch with the hearts of people on the other side of the political spectrum from myself, and at the same time more committed to going out and speaking my truth for my own political persuasion. So doing these mandalas, I'm now starting week 5 and plan to keep going until the end of December and then have a big show that has all of them in one place, which I think it will be very powerful. And I share them on my mandala blog.
Yeah, that's great.
And I make posters of them and pack them up around town.
There you go. Sounds great. Well, you know, I think, you know, that's the idea of transforming the angst that is surrounding, you know, the political arena right now. Is it would be such a good thing. And, you know, but even beyond that, you know, if if I mean that process of you know, collecting the items, doing the light white veil and then the flower up on top, to me that would be seem to be a great process for any kind of transformation that that one would want to go through.
Yep.
Yeah.
And another thing you can do that I do with mandalas is there's a process called mandala journaling that you just start with a blank circle, which provides a sacred and safe space in which to place images or colors or words or any combination that your psyche wants to give up after meditation. And then to identify the place in your mandala that has the most power for you, and to design a new mandala based on that place so that you go deeper and deeper with each successive mandala into the image and whatever your psyche is trying to bring up for you.
Wow, that's great. I like that application. Well, we're almost out of time, so I do want to just mention, too, that you mentioned your blog. So I believe it's called Creating Within the Sacred Circle. Is that correct?
Well, the blog is just my mandala blog. If you go to lindacarlton.com, then there's a mandala blog right there. And my whole website is called Creating Within the Sacred Circle.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know, Linda, I have really enjoyed our talk today. This has really been fun and informative.
I have too. Flown by. And
absolutely.
Thank you so much for letting me talk with you.
You're very welcome. And good luck with Amina's Fire. I hope it's a great success. And I'll be sure to follow you. I'm really, you know, interested in learning a little bit more about the mandala journaling and that kind of thing. So I'm going to explore your website a lot more. So I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me. All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Linda Carlton. We've been talking about her new book, Amina's Fire, as well as talking about mandalas. And again, you can find out more by visiting her website, which is www.lindacarlton.com. And again, there is a direct link to her website in the show page description. So, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again...
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Bite Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.